Welcome to READ, the Research, Education, and Advocacy Podcast. In this series, prominent researchers, thought leaders, and educators will share their work, insights, and expertise about current research and best practices in education and child development. READ is produced by the Windward Institute. I'm Danielle Scarano, Windward's research coordinator and a classroom teacher. I recorded this episode from home in the early spring during the COVID-19 pandemic. Education had left our school buildings, classrooms were empty, and learning had entered homes and virtual classroom environments. Given this uncertain time period, my conversation with this guest is particularly timely. And today I'm honored to speak with Dr. Margie Gillis, who is a champion in research and advocacy for research-based instructional practices in reading and teacher preparation and professional development. Dr. Gillis is a certified academic language therapist with a career in reading and teaching. In 2009, she founded Literacy How to provide professional development and coaching to help teachers implement evidence-based reading practices in the classroom. Dr. Gillis is the president of Literacy How and a research affiliate at Haskins Laboratories, where she creates new opportunities to empower teaching excellence. Before we begin the interview, I'd also like to speak on behalf of the entire WI team in congratulating Dr. Gillis, who received the first Lifetime Achievement Award from Smart Kids with Learning Disabilities in June. What an honor. Be sure to read my top READ bookmarks after listening to this episode on our website, readpodcast.org. Now on to the conversation. Good morning, Dr. Gillis. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you so much for being on the READ podcast. And usually I'm at Windward at one of our studios recording the podcast, and I never do this, but I thought I would set the scene a little bit, given that we are recording from home. I'm in fact recording from my dining room table, of all things. I just finished teaching To Kill a Mockingbird with my eighth grade students, and it just seems so wild that I'd be doing this all from home. And I would imagine that you've been mentoring teachers, working with Literacy How all week. What have you been up to during the social distancing?
Same. And actually, I'm at my dining room table and I extended it, put all the leaves in it, and it's completely covered with my resources and materials. And yes, I have been working with teachers, working with the mentors, doing a lot of virtual professional development, mostly through Zoom. And actually, I have some wonderful silver linings, and I'll share one of those with you, is I have two grandchildren, two little girls, and one is three and one just turned six. She's in kindergarten. And I've been teaching each of them every day. And it has been such a blessing to have the opportunity to teach again, because primarily what I do now is work with teachers. And I'll be talking a lot about that today. But the fact that I've had the opportunity to work with a preschooler and a kindergartner, and I've actually watched Reese learn how to read in the last 6 weeks. And it has been such an amazing experience to, you know, have that opportunity to teach my grandchild to read. And she, I will just say, I won't mention the school district, but she was not learning how to decode words. She was really hooked on looking at pictures and reading picture clues. And guess what? Now she reads the words, and we're using a wonderful decodable text series, and it's magical. It's just been so much fun to watch her develop these skills.
Oh, I absolutely love that you shared that story. It reminded me of when I was looking back at your bio on your Literacy How website. You wrote, Margie Gillis believes that there is no more important job than teaching a child to read. And I'll just repeat it again. There's no more important job than teaching a child to read. I mean, can I get that statement blown up and poster size framed? I think this statement speaks to your purpose and your impact throughout your career. So it's great to hear that story as well as more of a personal story. You did mention the three cueing system, and that gets me to the science of reading. And I want to talk more about that. So decades of research demonstrate what effective reading instruction is, particularly for early readers, for students with difficulties and language-based learning disabilities. What are those effective elements of reading instruction that are essential really for all students learning to read?
Well, it's a multifaceted answer to that question, because there is so much that teachers need to know. You know, we could start with kind of where the National Reading Panel guided all of us in 2000, what were the five core components of reading, and those were phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary, comprehension, and fluency. And so we use those five elements, but we've expanded those over the years to include oral language, and phonics includes teaching spelling, vocabulary includes teaching morphology, reciprocal to text comprehension, or at least related to text comprehension is written expression. So there's a lot of elements that go into comprehensive literacy instruction. And then most recently, we've talked about the structure of language, and International Dyslexia Association used the term structured literacy to include some of those elements that I just mentioned. So all of those elements are important and helping teachers understand the structure of language. And then I'll just mention a couple other important principles of effective instruction that include being very explicit and direct as you teach new concepts and skills, being data-driven, so looking at student data and making sure that you're being diagnostic using diagnostic data and being prescriptive in the use of that data. And then following a scope and sequence, which is super important when you're teaching the constrained skills of phonics. So really knowing where to start with more simple concepts and skills and then building into the more complex.
Interesting. So you've talked about these elements of effective instruction. What are some core competencies and skills that teachers need to demonstrate in order to effectively implement this in type of instructional pedagogy?
So again, going back to, you know, focusing on the structure of language. English has, you know, a very complex structure. Our language is based on phonemes, speech sounds. So you have to know the phonology of English. And then we also have morphemes that enter into the structure of English. So our language is both sound-based and meaning-based. So teachers need to know about the meaning base of the words in English. Many of them have what we call morphological units or morphemes. Like in the word unlovable, you have the base word love, but you have a prefix un. A bull is your suffix. You can figure out the meanings of words when you know those meaningful units. Our teachers also need to know about our orthography. Our orthography is how we represent those sounds and those meaning units. And our orthography is what we call deep because we have layers of influence in our language. So teachers really have to know how those different sounds are spelled based on what layer they come from in terms of our history. Teachers also need to know about syntax. So they really need to know how our sentence structure works. And because the texts that students read have many different types of sentence structures, they really need to know a little bit about, not a little bit, actually quite a lot about how words combine in sentences and what the role of each part of speech is in sentences. And then lastly, they need to know about semantics. So really the meaning base of words and how words are used. Again, English is a really rich, rich language, but it has its challenges. And when we think about semantics, one of the challenges is that we have roughly 60% of our words that are multiple meaning words. That means they could be used as nouns or verbs or as part of an idiom, an idiomatic expression. All of this makes English extremely rich and enjoyable to read once you know all of those pieces. But point is, teachers need to know all of that in order to convey those principles and elements to their students.
I'm reminded of the article in 1999, Louisa Moats's article, where she says, teaching is the job of an expert. And that brings me to educating teachers. So your research and advocacy work, specifically with Literacy How, and all the, you know, the decades of research in Connecticut that you've been doing is truly unmatched. And for all of us listening, I have to just put in a little individual plug, and the fact that I'm just really excited that we're talking, given that my dissertation is on this. So I'm educating, and we're educating all of our Read listeners, but Margie, you're also educating me, so I appreciate that. But what I've learned in the research and what you've talked about in a lot of your advocacy work and research work is that there are challenges at the pre-service institutional level in preparing teachers for reading instruction. But I want to focus on the effective professional development models. What does the research say about what effective professional development is and what features do you know must be in place for effective professional development?
That's a really important question, because we know that having an opportunity for a teacher to work with an expert who knows not only the theoretical aspects that I just described of language and of the content that we're focused on to teach reading, they also have to know how to translate that. And so the translation of the research comes in, you know, really in a, it happens really in the teacher's classroom. And it happens while a reading expert, a coach, we call our coaches mentors, are focusing on content and how students will acquire those skills, right? So it's really applied in their classroom. The teachers have to be actively engaged in this process. And we do that by focusing on what we call cognitive coaching, where they're looking at student data, they're looking at their own student data, obviously, they're figuring out what the student data is telling them, they're then forming a lesson or preparing a lesson based on that, they're seeing that lesson come to life in the classroom. And then post-classroom, you know, lesson, they have an opportunity to debrief and reflect with the coach, kind of facilitating a conversation. And that cycle gets repeated. So, but it really does engage the teacher actively. Another big piece is coherence, something I call coherence, where the goals of the professional development are aligned to what's happening at the district level, ideally, but certainly at the school level. And that this is not like a standalone or siloed from what curriculum is being used in the classroom or in the school. An example of that is many of our schools use Readers and Writers Workshop. We can't go into a school and say, you're going to get rid of whatever it is you're using to teach reading, and we're going to replace it with X, Y, and Z. That's not realistic. That's not what we do. But we have to show teachers how what we're showing them how to do and explain how we're doing our applied work fits into a framework like Readers and Writers Workshop. So again, that coherence, so it's not a standalone. I also think that having this professional development occur over a period of time, that's another principle and something we've learned from the research, that it can't be a one and done, right? It has to be sustained over years and embedded in the culture of the school. And then I think the last principle that I've learned a lot about is you have to have everyone sort of involved in it. Now, you know, when I say everyone involved, at least knowledgeable about goals of the professional development, be aware of it. They may not be participating fully, because that is not a realistic expectation that in a K-5 school, you would have all six grade levels and all teachers in each of those grade levels participating fully. But at least they know the principles behind it and why the professional development is occurring there.
So I hear what you're saying in terms of the features that are effective according to research. The one that spoke to me was the elements of sustained duration, which I think is important to emphasize, considering that one and done workshops or these one-time workshops would not fully build those teacher competencies. One thing that really stuck out to me was when you were talking about the schools that have the Readers Writers Workshop. And I've been particularly impressed with the advocacy work this year, let's say from Emily Hanford and others, who have really showed the difference between what explicit literacy instruction should look like. What would you say to those schools that don't use this evidence-based systematic instruction and are using, let's say, according to the research, less effective models? How might they incorporate these curriculums in their schools, and what would have to exist to fully put it into their schools?
That's a lot. There's a lot that has to happen, I think. First of all, I think there has to be an acknowledgement that there is a science of reading, and there, you know, we have to build our administrators and our teachers' awareness of this science. And as you mentioned, Emily Hanford's done a phenomenal job of raising that awareness. And we actually use her podcasts, and that has been very effective professional development with our administrators and teachers. And we actually play the podcast and we stop and have conversations. And it's been very, very powerful, because many of the folks that we work with are not aware of the science clearly. And you can't, you know, you have to be very gentle about it. You have to be respectful as you talk about the practices that they are using that are not effective, because they do feel, sometimes they feel personally affronted, they get defensive, and some of them get very sad and upset that they've been using practices that are not effective. And yeah, so you have to be sensitive to it. But I think that is a very important first step. And again, we're not going to say to a district or a school, you can't use that program or you can't use that method of instruction, because it's really very embedded in that school, and the teachers are entrenched in those practices. So our job as coach is really to first open their eyes and then show them what it looks like. And when you get into a teacher's classroom and the kids start to learn in ways that they've never done before, there's nothing more powerful than that, for a teacher to see his or her students learning things that they've never really been exposed to before, and then see what can happen once they have mastered those important foundational skills.
I would imagine that is something that is really special, and it seems to me to be a process.
It's a very you know, labor intensive process for sure. But yes, it is a process.
In listening between the lines, one of the things I'm hearing from you is this aspect of trust between expert and teacher. So how do you ensure that you're building this aspect of trust between experts and teachers and even school leaders that you're working with?
Yeah, you know, another really important question and a piece of the puzzle. Our mentors are people, right? So they have wonderful interpersonal skills, and the teachers find them very relatable. And they're non-judgmental, so that's really important. And they're not seen as the principal's, you know, sidekick or, you know, assistant. We do have relationship with the principals, we have to, but it's not to, you know, kind of tell tales out of school or to have private conversations about a teacher's practice. That really is sacred, and we cannot cross that line. And so it just takes time. For some teachers, it's easier than others, but it is fundamental. And I do think that having the teachers watch us with their students builds that trust. And it's a process for sure.
What I hear you're saying, and what I actually really appreciate you saying as a teacher, and actually, truth be told, of coming from a family of teachers, is that you respect the teacher's expertise as well, while also building their competencies and building their skill levels. And to me, that seems to be an important part of continuing to move the needle forward in helping students ultimately build their own reading skills. I've read a lot in research that brings to light the issues of scalability and sustainability of coaching models. What would you say in terms of the issues of scalability, and what do we really need moving forward?
Yeah, that's really a big piece of this, because the last thing we want is for our professional development and our hard work to go away when we leave. And, you know, there's no way that we can stay in schools indefinitely. So our goal is to find people internally and look for those folks that we can build capacity through and with, and work with administrators. Like, we have a great school district now that we've been working with. I've actually started working there 15 years ago, and now we're in, next year we'll be in all of their elementary schools. And the superintendent of this district is extremely supportive of the work that we're doing and has always supported. She's, you know, fairly recently become the superintendent. Prior to that, she was the person in charge of curriculum and instruction. And I would have regular conversations with her about the importance of having instructional coaches assigned to each school, whose job it really was to coach, versus what often happens in schools is those instructional coaches do everything but coach. And one of the reasons for that is they're not comfortable coaching. They didn't necessarily sign on to go into teachers' classrooms and model lessons and that whole process that I've been talking to you about. But if the district then sort of says, yes, we want to define this role clearly, and we want to make sure that those instructional coaches, one, have the content knowledge to be coaches, and two, have the knowledge about working with adult learners, because that's the other piece of the puzzle, right? Our mentors have spent, you know, lots of time learning about cognitive coaching and what does it mean to, you know, help adult learners gain this new knowledge and experience. So they just have to have a clear job description, and then that expectation has to be put in place. And if that happens, then those internal instructional coaches become our counterpart, if you will, our partners in crime, we call them. So they're internal to the district. They know the district's policies. They know the culture of the school. They already have relationships with the teachers there. And as external people, we can't tell anyone what to do. And so therefore, we have to work within those structures to be able to build the capacity and sustain our model. And so it really is both at the district level and at the school level that has to occur, I believe.
And following up on that, I have two questions. One is accessing urban schools. I also want to focus on the population of students that have diagnosed disabilities. So let's start with the urban sustainability. What would you say in terms of scaling these to larger urban districts? Because truth be told, in some of the research I've been reading, that seems to be one of the main issues. And maybe you can draw on some of your research as well as your experience in scaling your program to other schools.
Yeah, the large urban districts clearly are the most challenging for all the reasons that you know and we know collectively. And we have worked in those districts in the state of Connecticut. I think the systems that are already in place have to be acknowledged and addressed in some way. So I'm currently a member of the Connecticut Literacy Model Team, and we're working in two of these large urban districts. And really what we've been doing the last 2 years has been very eye-opening, and that is to look at what is currently being used to teach reading, what is currently being used to assess reading, and what are their systems for multi-tiered system of support or response to intervention. And when you dig into some of the, you know, specifics of that and look at how things are actually happening in schools based on current, you know, whatever the current regime is, you'll find that there's not a lot of good systematic instruction happening. Teachers are not being given good guidance as far as choice of materials and methods to teach reading. Likewise, they are assessing all sorts of things randomly. There's lots of redundancy in how assessments are administered, not much time given or attention given to analyzing assessment data. So those systems matter greatly. And if you can work with the district, going back to the earlier question, work with the district administrators and acknowledge that there needs to be a, you know, well-articulated plan for, you know, as I said, programs, reading programs, and I use programs, lowercase p, maybe it's a core reading program, but if it isn't a core reading program, it has to be well articulated what is expected. And then what is your support going to look like for teachers? Because professional development has to come into play here, but it can't be the superficial, like we talked about earlier, stand and deliver one PD and I'll see you next year. It has to be embedded in the school, in the classrooms.
Mm. And you spoke a little bit about this in your answer of accessing urban district, but just to reiterate, how are we ensuring that we are accessing the proportion of students that do have diagnosed disabilities or are showing signs of at-risk difficulties? Because from the research is that these systematic reading instructional programs are absolutely necessary for this group of students. So how are we ensuring that's also going into the schools as well?
Well, that's the big challenge, Danielle, because if you look at the data, you're looking at some of these large urban districts, you have, you know, maybe 30 to 40% of your kids reading on grade level. So what happens to the other, you know, 60 to 70% who need tier two and or have been identified, you know, to your point, with a learning disability, reading disability? You can't sustain that. You have to have supports for all those students who are not meeting the benchmark goals. But how do you do that? So we go back to, okay, take a look at what's happening in tier one, and tier one has to be addressed, you know, in large part. Not to say that you're not going to address what tier two needs to look like, tier three needs to look like, and special education as well. Those pieces have to also be addressed at the same time, but you're going to just be putting a Band-Aid on a huge problem if you don't address how reading is being taught in the first place. So that, you know, that's really a large focus of what we're trying to encourage and do is, you know, address all tiers of instruction and then support schools and districts in how they actually manage that process of getting kids in and out of tiers of instruction based on data.
That's a really good point to highlight at the end of our podcast. My last question for you is, as you know, READ is called the Research Education Advocacy Podcast. For me, advocacy is most important, and I think advocacy has been intertwined throughout our conversation. And your experts and insights illuminate how we can advocate for all students, and that is through supporting the system, supporting districts, ultimately teachers. What are your calls for next steps in advocacy in the upcoming school years?
Well, it's always been provide teachers with substantive professional development. So that's not going to change. Certainly what's changed in the last 6 weeks because of COVID is that we recognize now that we have to pay attention to alternate ways of working with students if and when this happens again, God forbid, or just in general. Technology is in our world to stay. We need to leverage it. We need to learn how to use it effectively. Teachers really don't get a lot of support in that regard either. So I do think that's a challenge that we need to face. I also think that we have our demographics will continue to change in that we'll have more and more children who come to us speaking English as a second or third language. So with that, we really need to acknowledge what our English learners need above and beyond what we're giving to our students who speak English, but even our children who speak English are not necessarily speaking academic English. So I do think a focus on what does that mean in terms of instruction, thinking about the not only the language differences, the linguistic differences, but also the cultural differences that our students are bringing to us. And then I mentioned this before, but I will say it again, this whole idea of providing support for teachers' use of data. They really, really are at a loss for how to use data effectively. And part of it is because it's a time issue. And they give the assessments, but they aren't given time to analyze the assessment data, or they don't know how to analyze the assessment data. So again, the assessment piece for me is really, really important. We have to streamline the process, but we have to give teachers the support they need to use the data to figure out what their kids need, right? And know if what they're doing is actually working, how they're teaching and what they're teaching is being learned by the students.
Absolutely. I appreciate you shedding to light these challenges and offering solutions and moving forward as we end the podcast. And I don't know if you realize it or not, but I think you have just opened up a conversation for many other episodes between you and I, if you're interested.
I'm game.
Yeah, I truthfully learned so much from you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me this morning.
My pleasure, Danielle. It was great to be able to share thoughts with you, and good luck with your dissertation. If I can help you in any way, let me know.
Oh, thank you for that offering as well. I think I'll definitely reach out.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening to this episode of READ. To learn more about READ or upcoming episodes, visit readpodcast.org. You can also access my top READ bookmarks or top moments from each episode by visiting each episode page on our website. My goal is to continue to connect and learn from inspiring leaders and advocates in research and education. If you have any thoughts, questions, or ideas of topics and speakers, feel free to reach out via email at info@readpodcast.org. I also invite you to like, subscribe, and share the Read Podcast with friends and colleagues. You can also like or follow Wynnewood's social media pages to find out more about upcoming speakers, episodes, and events. Until next time, readers.